Can you hear me okay? Can you hear me better now? Well, it's good to be back, and thank you for letting me share this with you. Alexander and I were in Israel this past October, and local Christian radio station, Faith Talk 1500, WLKV, put on this trip. By the way, they're doing it again this year. And originally, they talked to me about it, and we had this idea, let's get a couple of like pastors from the Detroit area, particularly guys who are on the radio or whatever. Let's get a couple of pastors, and they get their congregations. We all go to Israel together, and then all of us pastors could do some team teaching along the way, or as I like to call it, tag team teaching. Anyway, everybody else backed out. I said, I'm still going. I and my wife are still going. So we did. And this was a tour that, I mean, I didn't plan it. I'm just one of the people going along on the tour. And I was hoping to be able to do, you know, a little bit of teaching along the way. And I had mixed motives. Number one is just the idea of teaching from the Mount of Olives is huge to me. Secondly, by doing some teaching, the cost of my going to Israel, which the congregation underwrote, does not have to be taxed as income because I was doing ministry while there. Well, I was hoping to be able to do some teaching to A, I wanted to, B, to make it worthwhile, C, to make it legitimate as well. Turns out I was the only pastor on our bus. So I got to teach everywhere. It was fantastic. Basically, we had a tour guide, a guy named Ami. You'll see his picture. And everywhere we would go, he would give us the history and some of the archaeology. And I would basically give a reading from a passage of scripture that related directly to the place we were at. This is our bus. We were bus number 3. And let's see, is Ami in this picture? No, Ami, I think, took the picture. It's me holding a sign. Anyway, so that, let's see if I can do this right. Do I point this way? Anyway. Okay, it really works. This is Tiberias. This is a room, view from our room, from our hotel room. We landed at Tel Aviv, Ben-Gurion Airport, and immediately we went up to Tiberias. Tiberias is on the western shore of the Galilee, and Tiberias is one of the only places that anybody can afford to really live in Israel who wants to live in the Galilee, because it's beautiful up there. Everybody wants to live by the Galilee. And you can see out in the distance the palm trees and everything. We're going to see picture in a little bit, but right up there is what's considered the hillside where Yeshua gave the Sermon on the Mount. Everything's very close in Israel. It's not a big country. The whole country is the size of New Jersey. So that's Tiberias. This is up again. We're still in the Galilee. We spent the first 4 or 5 days just touring in the Galilee. This is an area called Tzipori. Tzipori is a bird. And beautiful, beautiful town of Tzipori. Pomegranates. I love pomegranates. You ever have pomegranate juice? Oh, it's just wonderful. And they got people, you go into Jerusalem or you go into Tel Aviv, and they got fruit stands there, and the guy's just making pomegranate juice. And he's got a box with hundreds of them, just cut it in half. You know, got the machine that just juices it. Get a glass like this of pomegranate juice. It's like, whoa, enough vitamin C for a month. Anyway, and it's really wonderful to see them growing. It is one of the 7 indigenous fruits that are grown in Israel. At Tzipori, they excavated what was a synagogue there. And so there we are, walking around the perimeter of the synagogue. You can see the mosaic floor. Very much a lot of it is intact. It's not big. It's not huge. Synagogues were not generally not all that big. The one in Capernaum was huge by comparison, but this was the synagogue at Sippori. Sippori was one town. In fact, it was kind of unique in the fact that during the Jewish revolt from 66 to 70 AD, Sippori did not join in the rebellion. So the Roman government was a little kinder with Sippori than they were with everybody else. And you can see the Hebrew on the mosaic. It's all survived. That's not reconstructed. That it survived. And it's beautiful. Also in Sippori was what they considered to be what was probably like the equivalent of not a castle, but a room for the nobility. A lot of famous rabbis ended up living in Sippori, and they lived rather well. And at Sippori, there, for whatever reason, so many of the mosaic floor tiles survived. And you can see this one is actually, does this also have the little pointer thingy? Oh, yeah, there. No, that's not it. Oh, it's on the side. Let's see. Green button in the middle. Oh, okay. See the waves? That represents the Nile. At Sippori, you kind of get a sense of how Judaism at that time was very comfortable kind of synthesizing and mixing with other cultures, and not in a way that you and I would necessarily approve of. But those waves, that represents the Nile River, because there was a whole tribute to Egypt there. And what you're seeing in Greek there is Alexandria, Egypt. And so it's just amazing how the mosaics have survived, and you can kind of reconstruct a little bit about what the Jewish faith looked like at that time based on what you find there. All right, let's see, next. Okay. Did I do something wrong? There's that, now there's... Did I inadvertently? Let's see. Oh, there we go, okay. All right, that's outside at Sippori. It's a large area, it's a large excavation. And again, you see that there are mosaics everywhere you look. Mosaic floors that have survived. This is not all that much to look at, but what you're looking at from a distance is Nazareth. That's about as close as we got to it. Certain areas, there are still tensions because of the tense relationships with Israelis and Palestinians. I'm taking that picture actually from Cana, where the wedding took place. You're not going to see any other pictures of Cana because it's just nothing to look at. It's really run down. It's kind of sad. This is not going to sound good, but I hate to say it, but it's true, and you might as well know. As you're traveling in Israel, some cities, some towns are Arab-controlled, and some are Israeli. The ones that are Israeli-controlled, you find all the archaeology, and they've really preserved it. If they discover something, they will build an area around it to preserve it. And they really take care of things. Unfortunately, in the Arab towns, they didn't seem to care. You can't tell too much from here, but see all the litter? Just everywhere in Cana was just litter. It was kind of a shame because I'm thinking the wedding story in John 2 is one of my favorite Bible stories. I was like, oh, man, come on, take care of the city. All right, this is us walking up what's called Mount Precipice. This is just outside of Nazareth. You're seeing Nazareth in the distance there. And you know, in Luke, when Jesus went to his hometown synagogue and began preaching, and everybody's, wow, this is wonderful. Where are all these graceful words coming from? How did he learn all these things? And then Yeshua says, let me tell you something. There were plenty of lepers in Israel in the days of Naaman, but only this foreigner was healed of his leprosy. There were many widows in Israel, but Elisha didn't go to any of them, but only to this foreign woman in Zarephath, right? In other words, he was challenging their nationalistic pride. And as you read in Luke, they got furious. They drove him out of the synagogue. It says they brought him to the edge of a hill to throw him off. It was Mount Precipice. And now you're going to see why. you are up there. And that's our tour guide, Ami, being rather brave. Well, actually, there's a few feet there. But anyway, yeah, it's quite a drop. And you're looking over the Jezreel there, the lower Jezreel Valley. There was a Chinese group there singing Heivenu Shalom Aleichem. It was great. I'm in Israel, and I'm hearing some Chinese Christians singing Heivenu Shalom Aleichem. I was like, wow, that's really cool. All right. And again, the view from Mount Precipice looking over the lower Jezreel Valley. And you see how wide and expansive that is. And how beautiful. Look at all that's being grown. Remember, when Jewish people began coming back to Israel in the late 1800s, it was desolate. Swamp land at some places and then just dry, arid, and nothing there. And they've really worked hard to make the land beautiful and fruitful again. So again, a view from Mount Precipice. And we took a boat ride on the Galilee. When you go to Israel, notice I say when, you'll probably be taking a boat ride on the Galilee. Probably not in the late afternoon or evening, because those storms still do whip up there. And the boat is about the size of the fishing boats that they had. There's a scene from on the Galilee, looking in. Oh, this was really cool. The Israelis love Americans, and they really love American Christians. We're the ones who basically keep the whole tourism industry going. They don't have that many Jewish tour groups. They don't have that many. And in fact, Ami, our tour guide, was saying, I love when evangelical Christians come. When Jews come, they just want to do the dead rabbis tour. Here's where that rabbi lived. Here's where that rabbi lived. Here's where they just want to do the dead rabbis tour. When Catholics come, they want to go to the shrine of this, the shrine of that, the shrine of this. When evangelical Christians come, they want to see the land, the history, where it happened, the archaeology there. And he loved that. So he was thrilled that we were there. And while we're on the boat, at one point, two of the boats together, we hooked up together, so two boats next to each other on the middle of the Galilee. They hoisted the American flag, and we all sang the national anthem. And then they hoisted the Israeli flag next to it, and we sang Hatikva, Israel's national anthem. There's a relationship there. By the way, you ever notice Jerusalem, the three middle letters? USA. The three middle letters of Jerusalem, it's nine letters in Jerusalem, the three middle ones are USA. And they discovered not too long ago, about a decade ago, they discovered when the tide was particularly low at one point, the water level was low in the Galilee, and they found something, they weren't sure what it was, they began carefully, you have to do everything very carefully because you're things are thousands of years old, and Israel Department of Antiquities wants to preserve things, right? They found what appeared to be an outline of a boat, and lo and behold, it was. And they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to carefully seal it within this foam stuff so they could, without breaking it apart, get it to come up from the sands. And they preserved it, and now it's in, and that's kind of what the fishing vessels looked like at that time. Another mosaic they found. This is what it looked like based on the reconstruction from that boat that they were able to dredge up. That's what a this well this is a miniature scale model, but it was the size of the boat that I showed you that we were on, which would be about from where I am to the door. Fairly big. The Mount of Beatitudes. Now, out there are now banana fields. But they planted those, I think, about 12 or 14 years ago. Before that, it was just grass. And when it was just grass, somebody could be right down there talking in their normal voice, and you would hear them way up here as though they were standing right next to you. The acoustics are perfect for it. This is one of the reasons they think this is probably the site of that, because it forms such a natural amphitheater. Oh, all right. The Mount of Beatitudes has just a lovely garden around it, beautiful. And of course, there's a Catholic church there to mark the place, but it's the gardens that are very beautiful. And everything's right along the shore of the Galilee. Again, Ami, our tour guide, giving us some of the historical background. I just thought that was a plaque I wanted to take my picture next to. Mount of the Beatitudes, blessed are those who have been persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you, right? When men revile you and hurl insults at you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely on account of me, rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For in the same way they treated the prophets who were before you. I just love that. So anyway, that's the story there. Then we went to Capernaum. It's actually Kfar Nahum. Nahum, the prophet Nahum. Nahum, Kfar means village. So Capernaum or Kfar Nahum is the village of Nahum. But you know what the Israelis call it? Probably just because it's easier to say Capernaum. I'm like, come on, man. I didn't come to Israel to have you give me bad Hebrew. Okay. Capernaum, the town of Jesus. It really was like headquarters for his ministry. And you're looking at what would have been the ground level of the synagogue there at Capernaum. And here is a side view, and you can see it's rather large and stately. And what you're looking at here, this level right here, this is dated to the 4th century AD. The darker stone down here, that was at Yeshua's time. And this was the synagogue. They reconstructed a good portion of it. The columns and the capitals. And do you see that there's some writing there? Yeah. Greek writing in a synagogue. Again, proof that Jewish people had to be trilingual at that time. You know, there was Greek, there was Hebrew, and there was Aramaic. And so even in the synagogue, you've got Greek inscriptions. This having to do with the family that basically contributed to the building of it. There's me and Ami doing some tag team teaching. And you notice everybody's sitting on two tiers. There's two tiers. That two-tier level of seating would basically wrap around the synagogue, first century synagogues, would wrap around. So you could have seating at two levels. Around the periphery. And in the middle would be where the Torah would be opened up and read from. So everybody's kind of sitting around the periphery. Again, just you can see, again, two levels. Okay, I always wondered, why did they put a spaceship? Why did they put a UFO in Capernaum? It's actually a Catholic church. I don't know why they fashioned it like a spaceship, but anyway. Right underneath there, now a lot of things in Israel, you have to separate fact, historical fact, from tradition. There's a lot of places we go where they say, we think this is where so-and-so did this, we think, and there are some places where we know based on inscriptions and archaeological findings. Right under that Catholic church, and I'm going to show you the picture right there, Peter's house. He lived in Capernaum. They excavated this and found inscriptions with his name. Shimon Kepha, Simon Peter. When you go to Israel, you have the opportunity to be baptized in the Jordan River. And I had the privilege of baptizing a number of people. You know, we're not treating it for most of them like the baptism, you know, when a person first comes to faith. But the idea of being a pilgrim and going to Israel and being baptized in the Jordan River for centuries and centuries, everybody's dream, right? The Greeks have a term for it. You're a Hadzi. If you go to Israel, if you're Greek and you go to Israel and you're baptized in the Jordan River, you become a Hadzi. Is considered a great honor. So now technically my wife is Alexandra Ann Hadzi Harris. And so we were baptized, and I got to baptize some people, including two little girls, 9 and 11. Their family, the father is the general manager of the Salem radio station in the Minneapolis area, and they went with us. And his daughters were waiting to get to Israel to have their baptism. I got to baptize them. So cool. It was so cool. You've, of course, heard of Mary Magdalene. What it means is Mary from Migdal. Migdal means tower. And it was the name of a northern Israeli town along the Galilee, Migdal. So Mary Magdalene means Mary from the town of Migdal. And guess what? About, I think it was 6 or 7 years ago, the Roman Catholic Church wanted to build a hotel there. Not a luxury kind of hotel kind of thing. It was more going to be like a retreat center specifically for women who had suffered abuse. And so a retreat center. But in Israel, anytime you're going to build something, obviously you pay for permits and all this, and you also have to pay for an excavation because they want to make sure you're not building right over something very significant. And so the Catholic Church gave the money, and they did their test dig, and lo and behold, they found the synagogue at Migdal. So they had to purchase land about 200 yards that way. But they still had to pay for the excavation. But anyway, yeah, the synagogue at Migdal, complete with the table. This is a facsimile of it because, you know, the real thing is in a nuclear-proof bunker in Jerusalem. Certain things you just cannot afford to just have the public, oh, this is lovely. Hey, Mom, look, I'm a Hispanic, you know. So you can't have things. Just, so this is a facsimile of the table that they would have unrolled the Torah scroll on. And you can see the imagery that's on there, the menorah, symbol of the land, and the jars of oil to feed the light in the temple. And this is a mikvah. Mikvah means a baptismal. And this one actually is one of the deeper, nicer ones. Usually the mikvahs are just sort of cut into the stone going down, and they're usually not that deep. This one was exceptionally deep, and you notice brick stairs, right? Cut stone. That tells us that the people in Migdal, at least those who financed the building of this this mikvah, had some money, because this was a much nicer, more defined than most of the mikvahs you see there. People would be baptized for various reasons. This is Megiddo, Mount of Megiddo, or Har Megiddo, from which we get Armageddon. Beautiful garden leading up, and it's a bit of a hike. 25 successive civilizations have built on that. It's just gotten higher and higher and higher, 25 separate layers. Now, some of them, it's a repeat. Egypt had a layer, and then the Assyrians, and then Egypt again, and then Canaanite, then Israeli, then Crusader, then Muslim, then Israeli. I mean, it's just 25 separate civilizations. Things get pretty high. So you can kind of see we're going to have a little bit of a trek going up. And then as we're going up, you see the water channel going down. Water control is a huge issue in the Middle East. You've got to be able to control the flow of water. A, you want to maximize your ability to use it. B, you want to minimize the amount of destruction from water that collects. So water control is a big issue, and they excavated the water channel there. Here we are about to go through what are considered the gates of the city. Just inside that entryway, there would be a seating area. It would be about from here to about here, a seating area on either side. Typically, when there was business to conduct, the elders of the city would gather just inside the gate of the city to discuss their issues. Also, by having a narrow opening into the city, you control who comes and who goes. You know, you need to have a certain amount of crowd control. That right there is an altar that they excavated at almost the highest point of Megiddo. That's a Canaanite-era altar. They sacrificed babies on that altar. And you can even see the stairs leading up to it right there. And I mean, on the one hand, it's marvelous to see all this history. On the other hand, it's horrible when you consider what was going on there. There's a close-up of it. And then again, you can see it from a little bit of a distance. And you can see right through this area out to the Jezreel Valley. I mean, it's a beautiful view. And so you can understand why the pagan civilization wanted to build their altar right there, kind of looking out over the expanse of things. But that right there is the highest point of Megiddo. And Israel was supposed to learn our lesson. God says, when I bring you into the land, I don't want you to do what the Canaanites are doing. What they do is an abomination. You are not to imitate them. Well, lo and behold, we didn't listen. These right here are markers of an altar that was built during King Ahab's time to Baal. We did the very same things. Me teaching from the highest point at Megiddo, overlooking the Jezreel Valley. This is where the last battle is going to begin. It's going to end at the Mount of Olives, but it's going to begin right here. And underneath Megiddo is a water cistern, deep, deep underground, hundreds of steps, like something like 180 or steps going down. And you walk through a tunnel. And when there's a lot of rain, it comes almost up and sometimes even over the bridge they're going through. Okay. I'm trying to remember the name now. This is where Gideon and his 300 men stopped for water. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the location. Beautiful, beautiful place. Elijah. So if that's Elijah, where is this picture? Say it loud.
Mount Carmel.
Mount Carmel. Up near Haifa. Beautiful, beautiful area. And we had the opportunity to worship with a Messianic congregation up at the highest point of Mount Carmel. It's a beautiful Messianic congregation. Dave and Karen Davis started it. Karen Davis grew up in Huntington Woods. And we know her a little bit, not a lot, but we know her. She's been to our congregation. And it was great to be able to worship together with them. It's a beautiful, beautiful synagogue building. And there's 12 stones surrounding the platform area, a stone for each tribe. And it's just beautiful. And people from all nations worship there. It really is a welcoming place for people from all the nations. And then the bus ride, because now we're headed to the Mediterranean. And this is Caesarea Maritima, Caesarea by the sea. There's another Caesarea up in the north called Caesarea Philippi. This is not that one. This is Caesarea by the sea. And look at this Roman aqueduct that has been preserved all this time. And that's just a portion of the aqueduct. It's huge. And I thought that was kind of neat to see the Mediterranean right through it. Herod had a palace up here. And this is probably a view that he had from his palace. We had lunch there. It was so windy that day. We didn't care. We're having a great time. Now, at Caesarea, they discovered a stone with this inscription. And you can see it says Tiberium, right? Underneath, you have, it would have started over here, but Pontius Pilatus. Yeah, Pontius Pilate. And of course, this is a facsimile because the original is in a nuclear-proof bunker in Jerusalem. At Caesarea, they excavated and restored a Roman-era amphitheater. And it is still being used today for concerts. You can see all the seating there. These are for concerts. It's just a beautiful area. Again, parts of the aqueduct, water control. The Romans really knew how to do water control. They really did. Here's a nice view of the Mediterranean at Caesarea. Notice the stadium seating there. You see how it's curved coming around here? This was the hippodrome. You ever wonder why they call it a hippodrome? Because they don't race hippos. That would be really boring. Hippos is Greek for horse. They did chariot races and such here, so it's called a hippodrome. Hippos. So hippopotamus, river horse, because potamos is river and hippos is horse. And there again you can see this is the track, essentially, a big oval. You think we were the ones who created NASCAR. Okay. And look at those beautiful drawings they found. Just beautiful. Now we're at Haradar. Haradar is, we're getting almost at Jerusalem. So we drove south, coming towards Jerusalem. And Haradar is a mountain. Har means mountain. Not too far outside of Jerusalem. And this is a war memorial because it was at this location in 1948 during the War for Independence. A fierce battle took place here, and a lot of people gave their lives here. So they have this memorial. You can't really tell from this picture, at least I can't tell from this picture, but the thing itself is about 170 feet high. You're climbing and climbing and climbing to get up there. So they have some tanks and things. I had to put that in because it was just, when do you catch sunsets like that? Right outside Jerusalem. And now we're at the Mount of Olives. Now, you guys have heard me do enough teaching to know that the book of Zechariah is very significant to me. And the Mount of Olives is so important in terms of eschatology. It's the last place that Jesus' feet touched before he ascended to heaven. And according to Zechariah 14, it's going to be the first place his feet touch when he returns to planet Earth. So I'm thinking to myself, if that's the first place his feet are going to set down, and according to the prophet Zechariah, the mountain's going to be split in its middle, why the heck are they building condos and apartments up there? They're going to have to rebuild it at some point. Now, normally, we were in Jerusalem for 3 days. The first day, we were touring the Mount of Olives and the Garden of Gethsemane. I'm going to show you some pictures of that. But what happened was, the next day we had a day off, and some people chose to do a separate tour up to Bethlehem. I wanted the day off to walk around Jerusalem, to walk through the old city, to spend time there. I don't know if you remember, but in October there was an attack. A Palestinian from East Jerusalem drove his car purposely into a crowd of Israelis that were waiting at a train station. That happened while we were there. You know how Israel has these checkpoints, right? And some people consider that wrong, and it's scandalous that they have these checkpoints and Palestinians have to go through and be asked questions and show ID before they can go on in. The reason those were set up is because suicide bombers were just coming in and setting off bombs at pizzerias and buses, residential areas, and so they had to put a stop to it. So they put these checkpoints in. If somebody's going to blow themselves up, it's going to be before they get to the checkpoint. They realized they can't do that anymore. They had to find new and creative ways to wreak havoc. So they started, and I don't know if you followed the news on this, there were like three separate car attacks where they would drive into groups of people waiting for trains. It was horrible. Well, that happened the day before we were scheduled to have our day off in Jerusalem. So we went into Jerusalem. Now, on any other 75-degree, sunny, beautiful day, there would be buses. The whole road there would be filled with buses, and you would see thousands of people. Do you see anybody? There's a handful of cars, and there's just nobody there because the tensions were very high the next day. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, had their people stationed all in and around Jerusalem. Now, everybody's still touring. There's still thousands of tourists walking around in Jerusalem. It's just that you would get redirected at certain points. And if you were Arab, they would stop and ask you a few extra questions for security purposes. So it was so quiet out there that day, and it was like nobody there. Let me see, what's the next one? Actually, let me back up for a second. Okay, Anyway, I want to show you that this was the newspaper headline, the Jerusalem Post, Friday, October 24th, because the Thursday was when it happened. Violence rages in Jerusalem as Netanyahu vows to restore quiet. They tell you about the car attack, right? And so that day we're walking in Jerusalem, and we had purposed that we wanted to go to the Eastern Gate. My wife and I and a guy named Paul Ridgway, who does an afternoon radio show in Minneapolis. And so we were already planning to go to the Eastern Gate because, you know, that's where Messiah is going to walk through, right? And, of course, there's all this tension. We managed to get out of the city and onto the eastern side. God must have made us invisible to the police because they didn't want anybody out there. Because over, where did I put the little thing? Because over about there, shots are going off. They didn't want anybody outside the eastern wall of the city. So I think God must have made us invisible because we made it out there without having to be sneaky. And either that or just we're the only ones crazy enough to go out there. But then all around certain parts of the city is police tape marking off certain areas. And in fact, I got a stone, Jerusalem Eastern Gate, 24 October 2014. Got that. You can't see because it's behind us, but is the eastern wall of the city. And now, if we could, Corey, show that video. I want you to notice as we play this video, and I'm going to do kind of a quick little panorama. You're only going to hear my voice and Paul Ridgway and my wife. It's very quiet. You might hear a car go by. Ordinarily, on a day where it's 75 degrees and sunny and it's a beautiful afternoon, there'd be tens of thousands of people there. And buses galore. Just crazy. You're going to hear pretty much quiet. Let's go ahead and play that.
The Mount of Olives.
Now, where is the Mount of Olives? Up there?
Yeah, it's kind of disappointing. Because the cemeteries were there always, pretty early. So it was right in...
Okay. Awesome. Anyway, so the Mount of Olives. Quiet it is? Normally, it's just like noisy with buses and buses and buses and people. It's just like we were the only three people out there. What made it real interesting is that I'm thinking, here it is. The tension is very thick. The ancient enmity between Isaac and Ishmael. And the fact that, there still is no peace. And there won't be until Messiah actually returns to planet Earth. And he's returning to that very place. And there we are. Three of us in the name of the Lord. And we were praying. It's just amazing. But there it is, the Mount of Olives. That is not just rock. That's not rock. You want to know what all those are? Graves. A good portion of the Mount of Olives. This, by the way, was taken the day before, which is why all the buses are there. There wasn't any buses the day we were walking there. But this was taken the day before. All of these. These are all graves, Jewish people going all the way up. And there's obviously limited room there. If you want to be buried on the Mount of Olives, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars to reserve a place for a tomb on the Mount of Olives. A couple famous people and a number of famous rabbis buried there. But you know who's buried right there? Zechariah. Not Zechariah the prophet, but Zechariah, the one about whom Jesus said, all the blood of the righteous, from Abel all the way to Zechariah, whom you murdered in the temple. Anyway, that's that Zechariah's gravesite right there. That's a close-up of it. And again, the whole hillside. What's interesting is when Jesus returns, those graves are going to be emptied out. Again, the Mount of Olives from the Jerusalem side. And of course, I'm pointing to where it's all going to happen. right there. I don't know that right there is where his foot. He could set his foot down over here, because the Mount of Olives, you know, it's kind of a range of hills. He goes, anyway. And Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives. And I think it's really kind of ironic that Jerusalem is so immediately recognizable, not by a Jewish building, but by a Muslim building. But it's, and over there is the Eastern Gate. I'm going to show you close up. 3, 2, 1. Nope. Okay, let's try it again. I must have done something wrong. There we go. The Eastern Gate. The Muslims, many years ago, cemented it shut because they don't want some Jewish Messiah walking through. And I'm thinking, really? Cement is going to stop the cosmic Messiah from going through? Yeah. And also they built a cemetery right there, figuring he would never walk over that because it would defile him. The tombs are going to be empty when he comes back. So it's just it's the lengths people will go to. This is the Garden of Gethsemane. Olive trees, some of which are 2,000 and more years old and still bearing olives. That one right there, we are pretty sure, was there at Yeshua's time and still bearing olives, and they still harvest them. Now we're walking into the old city, and you can just see kind of all the layers and how narrow things get for us. This is kind of a typical view of the old city, the streets going through. And there's lots to buy. Lots to buy. And this is Mahane Yehuda. This is the marketplace. It's huge because off of this main thoroughfare, there's all these side things. And you could spend 3 hours there and not see the whole thing. It doesn't occupy that big an area, but it's just there's just so much. And what's kind of funny is over here, you're getting fresh fruit. And over here, you're getting olives and spices. And over here, you can buy underwear. And then over here is car parts. And then over here is more fresh fruit. Yeah, it's not exactly all that well organized, but it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Ami, our tour guide, knows everybody. So he just gets behind the counter, and he's helping them fill our orders as we buy all these delicious spices and stuff. All right. When it comes to the question, who was there first? Palestinians have a narrative that they say, we have been here from time immemorial. Really? Do you know what you're looking at here? The wall, the fortified wall that King Hezekiah built in the 8th century BC. There are no Palestinians. There were Philistines. But modern-day Palestinians are not Philistines. They're Arabs. So it's just 8th century B.C., and there it is, and you can see it. Let's see what's next. This is not an ancient building. It's a modern building, but you notice everything blends. In Jerusalem, if you're going to build condominiums, apartments, houses, you're required to use what they call Jerusalem stone. They want everything to have a blended ancient look to it. This is the Ophel, the part of the city of David, right outside. This is the southeastern part of the wall of Jerusalem. And the archaeological excavation there is considerable. The Davidson family from right here in Detroit, Bill Davidson's family, they donated, I don't know how much it was, but a huge amount of money to have an archaeological park right outside the city walls of Jerusalem. This is the archaeological park there. And you know what that is. That's the Western Wall. The last remaining part of not the temple itself, but the outer retaining wall for the Temple Mount. It goes back, dates to Roman times, of course. People are praying there every day. And I prayed there too. And you want to know what I prayed? The note says, let me back up. Okay, the note says, Lord God, please bring my family members that don't yet know the Messiah. Please bring them to faith. And then what I did was I took a picture of the little piece of paper that I wrote that on. And I took this picture, and there's one more picture of me putting the prayer piece of paper into the wall, which is what people do, and I copied it to all my family so they could see. I prayed for you at the Western Wall in Jerusalem. A little guilt, right? Come on, get with the program already. All right, this is the shrine of the book. Inside, this is part of the Israel Museum, and inside there is a facsimile of the entire scroll of Isaiah discovered in Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls. The actual scrolls are kept in there. The original of Isaiah, and what's interesting is it's all 66 chapters on one scroll. It's not, you don't have Isaiah and then Deutero-Isaiah. It's the whole thing, and it dates to about 100 B.C., Now, prior to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the earliest manuscripts we had were Masoretic, which dated to about the 10th century A.D. So when they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls and they found, among other things, entire scrolls of Isaiah, it closed a 1,100-year gap. And so what do? You compare that 2,100-year-old copy of Isaiah to Isaiah in your Bible today. Lines right up. And you can see people at any given time of day comparing the Hebrew. It's phenomenal. I'm not going to say how I got this picture because you're not allowed to take pictures in there. But I managed to get it. I won't say that I took it, but I won't say that I didn't. And that's the facsimile of it because, again, the actual scroll is kept in, in nuclear-proof bunker, but also in hermetically sealed situation because it's so old. And this is the garden tomb. We're walking through the garden tomb. It's a beautiful garden. Now, here's where I take a certain issue with some of the traditions and some of what the tour guides want to tell you. They're saying that's Golgotha. That's the place of the skull. I'm like, okay, it doesn't take too much imagination, right? But that could be anything, right? That could just be a couple, with a little imagination, I guess that looks a bit like a skull. Until we walked about 100 yards further in, and Andrew, who's giving us the little lecture there, is talking, and I'm looking behind him, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me, that's the skull. Look at those eyes. Look at that. I'm convinced that that is Golgotha, not the other place which was way out there that they had us thinking. I think that's the skull. I mean, it's sure more striking. It was actually frightening to look at once I pointed it out to everybody. And we had communion there, the garden. Then we went to Masada. Down in the south, southern Judea, this is where Herod had a palace built for himself. Really, it was a place of refuge because who knows, at any particular time he had to run for his life, but he may as well live nicely. And he built up this beautiful palace way up on Masada. It is a cable ride up there. It's a cable ride. And you could climb it if you have the time and the energy, but... And all the young men and women who joined the IDF, when they swear into, finally, after they've gone through their training, and they're inducted into the IDF, they're inducted at the top of Masada, and they climb it. And you see the square areas? Those were the Roman encampments when they were basically trying to get the Jews who had captured the mount. And you can see, and this was actually a synagogue on top of Masada. Once the Jews captured it, they built for themselves a synagogue there. And what's interesting is there's a scribe who works there making copies of the Torah, a letter at a time. And if you give him a buck, he'll write your name on a little piece of parchment in Hebrew. And again, just some shots from the top of Masada. How's that for a view? That was the commandant's quarters. before the Jews captured it. A nice view. I thought that was kind of appropriate, considering the saying is Masada will never fall again, where Israel is determined to not give up ever without a fight. And then we came to the place I'd been longing to go to my whole life, En Gedi. En Gedi is where David hid from Saul. And there's a waterfall back there. And the first time I went to Israel, unfortunately, we didn't have time to go to En Gedi. I was like, what? What? I was really upset. I wanted to get under that waterfall in the place where David hid from Saul. Well, this time around, and I did some teaching there from En Gedi, out of Samuel. And there it is. Yeah, finally. I'd been wanting to do that for so many years. And I reached down after I got out of the waterfall and picked up one of the stones in the water there, Pool of En Gedi. And this is the Dead Sea. And that water is so thick with magnesium and sodium, you float on top. And you can't help but float on top. You don't have to try to float on top. You have to try to not float on top. It's wonderful. We covered ourselves in mud. And I did the whole mud thing. It was great. I'm not trying very hard. Okay. Come on. Yeah, there we are with the mud. Not only is Israel a place of discovery and wonder and faith, but it's just a lot of fun, too. This is from the city of Yafo, Joppa. It's called Yafo, which means beautiful or lovely in Hebrew, looking towards, and that is Tel Aviv. In fact, it's basically 3 minutes from here to there by car, so it's basically called Tel Aviv-Yafo. It's kind of like Dallas-Fort Worth. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Tel Aviv, Yafo. It's beautiful, beautiful, right along the Mediterranean. And Alexander and I hired Ami on another day where we had a day off to take us to a couple of places we wanted to see, just private tour. And you are looking over the Valley of Elah. You know what happened in the Valley of Elah? David faced off against Goliath. The Israelis and the Philistines. And that's where it takes place. And what you're looking at here is Sha'arayim, which means gates. The town was called Sha'arayim because it had multiple gates. And we've got a video for a few seconds so you can get a sense of Sha'arayim. And
again, just one more panorama from up here at Sha'arayim, the Valley of Elah. Probably where that battle between the Philistines on the far side and Israel over here, and David and Goliath would have met in the middle and met for battle somewhere right around here. Again.
Amazing. And look at the excavation right there. And what's interesting is you're walking around Israel, and everywhere you go at places like this, everywhere you go, there's stones, including stones like this. Notice it's got a straight edge. That's not a rock. This is a tile from a floor from northern Israel, as is this smaller one. I think this one was from around Sha'arayim. This one was from Megiddo. Anyway, it's not like I was stealing precious antiquities from Israel. They're everywhere, just everywhere. Just everywhere you go. That's a floor tile. Yeah, there's another one. Yeah, that's part of a mosaic. Everywhere. It's just amazing the history that's there. Some of us from my congregation, my wife Alexandra, who some of you have met. I need to bring her back here to Dunning Park, and some other ladies from our congregation. And, oh, how did we get to that? That's it then, right? That's it. Okay. So, all right, a little bit of the history and the archaeology and the beauty that is Israel. I should mention, not tomorrow, but Tuesday, I'm going to be talking with Chris McCourtney at Faith Talk 1500 because they are planning a 2015 trip to Israel. So I can always get you, I'll send it through Leo, but I'll get you guys information if you'd like to consider going to Israel in 2015. I'm hoping to go. Kind of, my wife wants to go again. And if I do, I'm going to be doing a lot of teaching again, which I love to do. But you know how the thing works? For every 10 people that the pastor gets to go, the pastor's trip is paid for. If you get 20 people, the pastor and his wife are paid for. Anyway, that's, of course, nothing is free. But in any case, so there is going to be a 2015 trip to Israel. Let me talk to you very briefly about evangelism in Israel. We had so many opportunities to talk to Israelis about Yeshua, about Jesus. And they are very open to talking about it. You know, if you're an Israeli, there you are. You speak Hebrew, you live in the land of your ancestors, you know, even if you're not religious, there you are. You're a Jew. You're living in the land. And so Jewish people living in Israel are very comfortable in their skin, very secure about their identity, so they don't feel threatened to talk to you about Jesus. Here in America, Jewish people tend to feel a little more threatened about Jesus because we've been told all our lives you're not supposed to believe in him, and Jewish people here don't generally speak Hebrew, and so many Jewish people are not religious, so there's very little there in terms of having a secure identity. So sometimes the only thing that really gives a Jewish person a sense of identity is what they don't believe. So, but in Israel, it's not that way at all. We're walking along, and this guy I told you about, Paul Ridgway, who does that afternoon show in Minneapolis. First of all, if he's anything, he's 6'3", 6'4". He's just a big guy, and he's so friendly. He loves everybody. And he's just going up to Israelis, "Hi, we're evangelical Christians from America, and we love Israel. And this is my friend Rabbi Glenn, and he's Jewish, and he believes in Jesus too." Now, in America, they'd be going, "Ugh." Over there, they're going, "Really? That's interesting. What is that? How do you do that? How does that work?" We had more conversations with people than I can even remember. It's just, they're very open to the gospel. So Israel is a place where there is a lot of gospel ministry going on. Jews for Jesus has a very strong presence in Israel. They have what's called amuta, which is legal recognition to function as an organization in Israel. You have to have what's called amuta. Jews for Jesus has it. And they've got a staff of, I think, 60 or 70 people doing full-time ministry, a lot of evangelism in Israel. They're making quite an impact there. There are something like 50 or 60 messianic congregations in Israel. Now, that said, we're still a teeny tiny minority. You know, there's probably about 10 to 12,000 Jewish believers in Jesus in Israel, which is like teeny tiny when you're talking about 6 or 6.5 million Jewish people. You know, 10 or 12,000 is like barely a drop in the bucket. But that's fine. God has always worked through a remnant, right? A little remnant, and that's okay. So evangelism is going on, but you know who has the best opportunities to witness to Jewish people, both in Israel and here? It's not me. It's you. When a Jewish person finds out that you love Israel, that you care about the well-being of the Jewish people, and that you know the Old Testament probably better than they do, they're fascinated with that, and they want to know why you care. We had Israelis, why do you... They love American Christians, but they're still a little bit baffled. Why is it that you love Israel? Why is it that you care about us? And it gives an opportunity to share why it is that we love, and it's because of Messiah, Jesus, who said he was the Messiah. It's a wonderful opportunity. So if you ever get a chance to go to Israel, and I hope you do, you'll have lots of opportunity to share with people the gospel, and I encourage you to do that. Here in America, it's a whole different ballgame. But even here in America, you are the ones with the advantage. I can't tell you how many times people said, "Well, if I was Jewish, you know, I'd have more success," right? Reaching Jewish people. No, because your friend Glenn is considered a traitor. I'm considered to have turned my back on my people. Jewish people don't want to talk to me, but they'd be more than happy to talk to you, because if you're not Jewish, well, of course you're Christian. That's the thinking. But at least there's an open door there to talk. So I want to encourage you, if you ever thought that that you're at a disadvantage reaching out to Jewish people because you're not Jewish, you've got it backwards. You're the ones with the advantage. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. So I want to encourage you to take the opportunity, share Jesus with your Jewish friends. Look, maybe they'll blow you off, but maybe not. And even if they blow you off today, you're the one who cared enough to talk about them. And when that day comes and they're bewildered or grieving and need answers, you'll be the one they call because they know you're the one who cared enough to talk to them about what it means to know God. So now, I also told Leo that I wanted to take a few minutes and give you an opportunity to interact with me. I will tell you that there's a lot of organizations that are claiming to do evangelism, claiming to do ministry, claiming to do good things in Israel and for Jewish people. You need to have discernment. Not all of them are kosher. I mean, if you really wanted to play it safe, I think the best bang for your buck in terms of evangelism is Jews for Jesus. I mean, just without a doubt. Chosen People Ministries is a good ministry, and they are operating in Israel as well. But there are organizations that you shouldn't, that as far as I'm concerned, you shouldn't give to. I just started getting mail again from the so-called International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. Rabbi Yehiel Eckstein, any of you get mail from International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, you need to know, number one, Rabbi Eckstein is not a messianic rabbi. He quotes scripture as though he is, but he is not. Not only is he not a believer, he's an Orthodox Jew who is particularly hostile to people like me. And now he gets, I mean, tens of millions of dollars come in every year from evangelical Christians to the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. And he funnels that money to organizations that are doing charitable work in Israel. Unfortunately, some of those organizations are ultra-Orthodox, and they actually persecute Messianic Jews. So people don't even realize they're giving to an organization, and it's actually some of those monies are hurt to harm Messianic Jews. So you need to know that. Also, you need to know that, you know, as ministries go, there's a thing called Ministry Watch. Are you familiar with it? It's a really great website, Ministry Watch. They evaluate percentages within charitable 501c3 organizations. How much of it is actual program work versus how much of it is fundraising versus how much is salary and such. And how transparent are they about their finances? And some of them get a good grade and some don't get such a good grade. But one of the things they list on there is salary, the CEO's salary. Now, the CEO, for example, of World Vision is something like $470,000 a year. I mean, that's a lot. But do you know what Rabbi Eckstein's salary and benefits was in 2012? $1.2 million. As far as I'm concerned, that's just unseemly. For somebody to be pulling in that kind of money doing nonprofit work, I have a problem with that. Anyway, but there are other organizations. Somebody asked me, is Zola Levitt good? Yes. Of course, Zola Levitt himself is with the Lord now. But Zola Levitt Ministry is a good ministry. It's a teaching ministry. They're bringing out the Jewish background of the New Testament. It's a very worthwhile ministry. I don't know how much they're doing in terms of actual evangelism. I don't know. They may be doing a lot, but I don't know. But that's good. But I wanted to open it up. If you have questions about what we looked at tonight or about Jewish people or about organizations that you've been hearing about that you're curious about. Friends of Israel, that's a good ministry. Yeah, they do evangelism. They do a lot of teaching. They do a lot of relationship building. They're not going to be as direct in terms of evangelism as Jews for Jesus. Jews for Jesus are the ones who are just like really out there. Okay, Friends of Israel, though, is a good ministry, very legitimate, on the up and up. You can feel good about that. Ein Harod, yeah, Ein Harod. Yeah, not Herod, but Harod. Yeah. No, this was only my second time. First time was in 06. Yeah, the water level has gone down dramatically. But it's really felt at the Dead Sea because water is being used, you know, the salt, the concentration of salt, Ahava, cosmetics, and, you know, Dead Sea salt. You know, I mean, so the water level has plummeted, plus water is being provided to Jordan. So, I mean, it's, but Israel's gotten more snow and rain this year than in previous years. So, I mean, that's always nice. When there's snow in Jerusalem, that means there's snow up on Mount Hermon, which means there's going to be more water flowing down from the upper and lower Jordan valleys, which is good for everybody. Yes, you can go into the... I didn't do it this time because I had been in... I don't know. We don't know for sure that that's the tomb, but I'm pretty sure that's Golgotha based on that rock formation. But yeah, you can walk into the tomb. Well, you can crawl into the tomb. Yeah, good. Which one? That is the Russian Orthodox Church. Yeah, it's a Russian Orthodox Church. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. I wish the Russian Orthodox Church wasn't so anti-Semitic. But anyway. Yeah, there's a bad history there with the Jewish people.
Are there congregations where there are Palestinian believers, evangelical Christian, and Jewish?
There are. In fact, Kehilat Carmel that I told you about has people from all backgrounds, Arab background, Muslim background, believers, Ethiopian believers, Nigerian believers. Dave Davis was the senior pastor. At this point, he's the pastor emeritus. Their senior pastor is a Japanese-American messianic believer. But it's a congregation for all nations, and a lot of the congregations in Israel have that kind of multi-ethnic, multinational complexion, because think about it, this people from all the nations are there. And I think that's great, because Isaiah 56, God says, my house will be called a house of prayer for all the peoples. So I feel very strongly about that. Yeah.
I've heard it said that in reading various historians and conflicts, that in Israel there's actually very little, if any, mention of King David in archaeology.
It's true. Up until about a decade ago, there was very little archaeologically to go on. There are, in terms of inscriptions, in fact, some scholars suggested that King David was the ancient Jewish equivalent of an Arthurian legend. But I think it was 10 or 12 years ago they discovered a stone with an inscription that had King David's name on it. And it was authenticated, and I think there's been one or two other discoveries that kind of lend to that. So one of the things to bear in mind is that, for example, like in Egypt or in Assyria, they kept exhaustive records of everything. And in Egypt, etched in stone. In Assyria, you have the... Persia, you had the Cyrus cylinder, right? In Israel, things were mostly done on papyrus or vellum, and those tend not to survive quite as well. So we don't have a lot of things that you necessarily expect to find King David's name written, actually, into a stone thing. So the fact that they even found one is huge, and it's in the Israel Museum. You can see it. But yeah, there isn't a lot in terms of actual inscriptions. But what there is a lot of is the actual archaeological sites match up word for word in terms of what you find when you get there with the biblical narrative, where walls were built, how they were formed, how many gates, things like that. That all seems to line up. So I take it that there's no reason necessarily to doubt the Davidic narrative since everything else, every single discovery seems to authenticate what was written, so I have no trouble believing the historicity of the David narratives either. The genealogies were housed in the temple. And when the temple was destroyed under Titus's invasion in AD 70, one of two things happened. I tend to think that the priests took the genealogical records along with other irreplaceable things and hid them somewhere. They have not been found. It's possible that they were destroyed in the destruction, but I tend to think not, because we held off Titus's invasion or the siege for at least long enough that there were tunnels underneath Jerusalem. You could get out to the wilderness and nobody would ever catch you. So chances are they are existing somewhere, and in what condition, who knows? Where, who knows? But we don't have them. And that's huge, because anybody can come along and say, I'm the Messiah. The first thing you say is, well, let me see your genealogy. Can you show that you're a descendant of Abraham and that you're a direct descendant of David? And nobody can do that, because we don't have those genealogical records. So as far as I'm concerned, the Messiah had to come, as Daniel says, before the destruction of the Second Temple. And nobody today could prove that they were the Messiah based on their ancestry. And that's the first line of attack. Notice Matthew starts out his gospel with a genealogy. You thought he was just trying to be boring. No, he's trying to establish the credibility of the genealogical line of Jesus, because that would have been the first line of attack. You know, in all the ways that the religious leaders, the scribes, the Pharisees, the Torah teachers, tried to find something to get Jesus, to trap him or to discredit him or to stop this thing, the first line of attack would have been his genealogy. If you find a flaw in his genealogy, the whole thing is shut down before it ever gets off the ground. And they had the genealogies available to them. And there's no record of them saying, you can't be the Messiah because you have the wrong ancestry. So, yeah, that's why Matthew starts with a genealogy. That's your first point of making this is legitimate, this claim is legit. Any other questions?
Mike Evans? I don't know who
he's Mike Evans. Thank you for asking. Mike Evans, I'm sorry to say, is one of the people that should not be supported. I used to get mailings from Mike Evans all the time. Very emotional, high emotional pitch for money. And I remember seeing pictures of Mike Evans with his arm around Teddy Kollek, who was the mayor of Jerusalem. See, look, I'm rubbing shoulders with Teddy Kollek, and you're given the impression that he's doing evangelism, and he isn't. And he wasn't. So based on the high-pressure letters that he would send out and the fact that he really wasn't doing evangelism, he was just doing photo ops and making it look like he's doing ministry, I don't suggest to support Mike Evans. He's a very good writer, though. What do Jewish people do now, or I should say not do?
Right.
Leo, can I ask a big favor? Could you just go refill that for me? Thanks. For the vast majority of Jewish people, the whole sacrificial system is a non sequitur. First of all, and I'm not exaggerating when I tell you that 90% of Jewish people don't even really practice Judaism today. They're culturally Jewish, of course ethnically Jewish. Their value system tends to reflect a tightly knit community. But most Jewish people are not religious. And most Jewish people don't read the Bible at all. So for 90 out of 100 Jewish people, the whole idea of the sacrificial system, they have no idea what that's even about. And those who do, thanks so much, brother. And those who do think it was archaic and barbaric and want nothing to do with it anyway, they wonder why the Orthodox pray that the temple might be rebuilt. And So, I mean, 9 out of 10 Jewish people you're ever going to meet, it's not even an issue. Unfortunately, my people are biblically illiterate. And they don't realize that there is an issue, because both Leviticus 17 and Hebrews 9 tell us that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins. Most Jewish people don't even know what sin is, don't know why blood has anything to do with it. All I can tell you is, like most Jewish people, before I knew the Lord, I didn't know anything about any of this stuff. I never read the Bible. I didn't know these things. I just remember as a brand new believer, the first time I heard them singing, "There is a fountain filled with blood flowing from Emmanuel's veins," I wanted to throw up. Because it was so not anything that I understood. So it's not an issue. Most Jewish people are not wondering, how am I going to have atonement for my sins? Because most Jewish people don't know what sin is, imagine themselves generally to be good, nice people. And so it's just like, woo, that doesn't register. Well, can I just recommend you not go around saying that?
I have lots of Jewish American friends that aren't waiting for Messiah.
Right, right. Oh, yeah. Right. I mean, honestly, for the vast majority of Jewish... Right. The average Jewish person, especially here in America, is not religious. So they know, they've heard the term Messiah. They don't know what that really means necessarily. They certainly don't know any of the scriptures pertaining to it. They just know that Jesus isn't him, because that's what they were told, and that's what we believe as Jews. So, most Jewish people aren't trying to keep kosher either. So, again, most Jewish people don't know the Bible, don't practice Judaism, are culturally Jewish, but we've been told from the time we were this big, we don't believe in Jesus, he's not for us, and that's all we know.
So would you ask one?
Ask one?
You know, ask
a Jewish person, yeah.
So why is Jesus not the Messiah? They just say, that's what I was told?
It depends. It depends how honest the person is being with you. Look, there, you might meet someone who says, "Look, I'm kind of curious who Jesus is, but you know what? I'm Jewish. I don't dare go down that road." They're being honest with you. Then you have people who say, "He didn't fulfill all the prophecies that the Messiah was supposed to fulfill," and not that they've ever read any of them. It's just what they've heard. To which your response should be such as, Just two words. When somebody says, "Jesus didn't fulfill the prophecies," such as, and let them squirm a little. "Well, there isn't peace on earth. Where does it say that the Messiah is going to bring peace on earth?" Let them squirm a little bit. Say, "I could tell you, but I can tell you there's a whole lot of prophecies that talk about upheaval and things that the Messiah is part of this whole thing, the dynamic where it's upheaval, and that the world is going to reject him and is not going to want peace." And when somebody's intellectually dishonest with you, call them on it in a nice way. I'll give you a sample of how I do this. Somebody says, "Jesus didn't fulfill the prophecies. There isn't peace in the world." I said, "What prophecies?" "Such as?" "I don't know. There's prophecies unfulfilled." Can you name one for me?" "No." "So is it safe to say you really haven't studied the Bible?" "Yeah." If I'm talking to a guy, I'll say, "So did you ever see the movie The Secret Garden?" Total chick flick, right? "No." "You didn't see The Secret Garden?" "No." "What do you think about it?" "What did you think of it?" "I just told you I didn't see it." "That's all right. Tell me what you think about it." "I don't know, I haven't seen it." I thought, you know, you're commenting about a book you haven't read. I thought maybe you want to tell me about a movie you haven't seen. And if it's a woman, I'll use Terminator 2 Judgment Day, you know. Intellectual integrity. if you can do it in a good and humorous way, call people to intellectual integrity. Yes. Okay, well, most Jewish people go to synagogue twice a year. Sound familiar? You want to come up and teach? Okay. Well, what happens in the synagogue? A lot of prayers are read. A portion from the Torah, the five books of Moses, is usually canted in Hebrew. It's not read, it's sung in Hebrew. How many Jewish people speak Hebrew and can just know what they're hearing? About the same number of Catholic people who can do that with Latin. So in other words, there's a lot of liturgy and antiquity about it, and it's very beautiful, but most Jewish people have no idea what they're hearing and really are not all that plugged in. I remember as a brand new believer, I'd just been in the Lord, I don't know, a couple of months or a year, and I was back home in Los Angeles, and on a Saturday I decided to visit my old synagogue where I had my bar mitzvah, and I'm listening, and I'm following the prayers in what's called the Siddur, the prayer book, and they're beautiful prayers. I'm like, this is fantastic. How come I never, appreciated this? And I'm just, wow, this is great. And I'm looking around, and everybody's just like, oh. How's your son? And she's like, there's treasure here and we don't get it. Anyway, so most Jewish people don't even go to synagogue very often unless it's the high holidays or Passover or their friend's son or daughter's having a bar or bat mitzvah. But it's a combination of prayers, reading from scripture, then what's called the Haftarah reading, which is a reading from the prophets, more prayers. There's typically a homily, but it's usually about 5 minutes. It's very short. And a lot is made out of the bringing of the Torah out of its ark. A lot of pageantry in terms of when the Torah scroll itself is brought out of the ark and opened up. And there's prayers associated with the opening of it, prayers before each reading. So there's the Torah really is like the centerpiece of everything rather than the sermon. So it's different in that regard. It's different in that regard. Okay. Okay. When you have a Jewish friend who's lost a family member or a loved one, and they're sitting, what we call sitting Shiva, Shiva from the number 7, because for 7 days the family will be in mourning. Best thing to do is, bring some food, sit with them, tell them you love them, ask them about the person who's passed away. Ask them, what was he like? What was she like? What are some of your fondest memories? Just show that you care. That wouldn't be a time to try to introduce the gospel unless the person is asking you. And even then you can say, do you feel comfortable talking about it? Because maybe we would talk about it, a week or two from now. We'll sit down over coffee and talk. You can always set up an appointment, as it were. But just show that you care. Show that you care. It's when you have that priestly kind of ministry that sometimes opens the door for later on the prophetic type ministry, bringing the word. So sometimes you're just loving and showing support, and down the road there will be an opportunity to share your faith. And look for every opportunity you can. And did you have a question as well?
Yes, there's an organization that has set up a Sanhedrin and people who are studying for the priesthood, as well as the implements for the new temple have already been made. Is that legitimate?
Yeah, there's a certain amount of preparation that's been going on in terms of anticipating that the temple will be rebuilt. Because you look at Scripture, that's not an if, that's a when. And that's not an Old Testament thing. That's 2 Thessalonians 2. So, now, that said, there's a lot of hype about all of that. take some of the hype with a grain of salt. How far along they are, you know, you'll every so often I hear a red heifer has been, you know, and the ash, the red heifer, and every so often the priest's garments, and every so often I hear about, well, they're talking about the location of the temple, you know, I'm like, you know, that's all fine. Let's stick with sharing the gospel, because even good things can still be a distraction from the main thing. You know, there's a big issue about the land and the conflict between the Jews and the Palestinians over the land. And I'm not saying it's unimportant, but first and foremost, we need to be sharing the gospel. I mean, that's our first calling. So, Leo.
I see a lot of that, and I can understand the excitement from Scripture in that, but isn't that really the beginning of the tribulation and the loss of many Jewish lives as well?
It is. I mean, see, this is the thing is, one of the dangers is that the Jewish people cease to be an actual people, and they become a convenient kind of a time measurement. People stop thinking of Jewish people as people who need the Lord and who have genuine needs, pains, hopes, disappointments, and start thinking of them only in terms of, well, how do they help me? How did the presence of the Jewish people in Israel help me figure out where we are on the prophetic time clock? And when you do that, you objectify people. We need to be careful not to do that, but to just care about people. All right. Well, thank you. Leo, I turn it back over to you.
Well, Glenn, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Quite a